My guest today, Philip Giraldi, is a former CIA counterterrorism specialist and military intelligence officer who served 18 years overseas in Turkey, Italy, Germany, and Spain, and is currently president of the Washington-based Council for the National Interest. He is a regular contributor to www.antiwar.com and a contributing editor, and writes a deep background column on terrorism, intelligence, and security issues for the American Conservative magazine. He has been interviewed on virtually every major TV network in the U.S. and most of the important ones abroad, and I'm pleased to have him back here on Takes on the World for a third visit. Welcome, Phil Giraldi, to Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
I'm glad to have you back. Well, since the first bombs began falling in Baghdad 8 years ago, there's been a steady drumbeat for an armed conflict with Iran, and in recent weeks it's accelerated, first with the arrest of an Iranian-American accused of a scheme to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington, and most recently a new report by the International Atomic Agency Commission, whose findings appear to have been twisted and hyped, much like that of we saw in the lead-up to the Iraq War. Is this, as Yogi Berra would say, deja vu all over again?
Yeah, I suspect it is. I mean, what surprises me, and I think from your tone of voice, what surprises you also is the fact that they're using exactly the same scenario, playing out exactly the same game, and the objective is exactly the same, to go to war with a country that doesn't threaten the United States in the least.
Well, it's interesting. There is no, it seems, any debate of the right of the United States or even Israel to attack a country that may or may not have atomic weapons, when we have, of course, Israel itself has several hundred, which no one talks about, the president is not even allowed to mention, and we have Pakistan and India, both who developed nuclear weapons and without the world's permission, and yet nobody's threatened to attack either one of them. What does this tell you?
Well, it basically tells me that the whole threat narrative really is all about Israel, because if in real terms, if you're looking for what kind of threat Iran represents, Iran basically threatens only one country, and that is Israel, because both Israel and Iran, in a certain sense, aspire to be the major military or the major the dominant power in that region. So it's kind of a local politics playing out on an international scale.
Well, of course, does Iran really threaten Israel in terms of militarily? I mean, if let's say Iran had a bomb, any country that would use a bomb other than the United States would be subjected to immediately, for example, Pakistan would use the bomb, to a counter-attack, a nuclear attack. So this would be suicidal on the part of Iran, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're absolutely right. The fact is that even this threat narrative about Iran really is pretty much a fiction. And the former head of Mossad has basically said this talk of attacking Iran is crazy, and other senior Israeli politicians, though admittedly usually when they're out of office, have said that the Iran poses no threat against Israel, really. But so this narrative is a bit of a fake, and the what they fall back on, as I'm sure you've heard, is to say, well, Iran is not a rational player. Iran is suicidal. If Iran had one bomb, they would detonate it over Tel Aviv, and it's because they're crazy. Even knowing that they would be completely, their own country would be completely destroyed on the following day. So, you know, when you get into this craziness argument, there's really no counter to it, because, you know, you can ascribe all kinds of motives to all kinds of people for various reasons.
Well, one might question the rationality or the sanity of the current leaders of Israel, should that, and those who support the bombing of the United States, because should that attack be made on Israel, on Iran's nuclear facilities, obviously Iran has plans to close the Straits of Hormuz. They can attack the Saudi oil fields. They can attack U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. We might see the world economy that is already on the brink of collapse, certainly Europe is tottering, go over the edge, and that doesn't seem to bother them at all.
You're right. All of what you've said is very plausible. Iran, our military insists that Iran is not a major military power, which is true. But at the same time, they would be operating on what they called interior lines, since they basically would be able to attack in a number of different directions, and they could do all the things you suggest. The thing doesn't make any sense on any level, but we've seen lots of stuff over the last 10 years that hasn't made sense on any level, and it still happens. So I fear that if there is a war with Iran, it will probably be something that almost will happen by accident, but it could happen.
Now, I'm going to get to these two things I mentioned when in my opening question. We now have the new IAEA report, which leaked like a sieve, and was twisted and hyped and has been misquoted, misinterpreted. It seems, however, also that, I don't know, Yukiya Amano, or we could pronounce him Yukiya Amano, which is where I live, the new IAEA chief, is a puppet of Washington, and he must have been responsible for those leaks.
Well, I think probably those leaks came from a number of directions, including Israel and the United States. But the report basically came from Israel and the United States. It was a compilation of intelligence reports provided by Washington, provided by Tel Aviv. And even then, if you read the report carefully, they almost never could say anything definitively. They just said, it appears, it is possible, it might be. And the report actually doesn't say much of anything in terms of some kind of, you know, smoking gun or silver bullet showing that the Iranians have a nuclear weapons program. It doesn't demonstrate it at all.
Well, even U.S. nuclear experts, people who don't have a particular bias or player in the field, have said that that information in it is not new and has been around for years. And while Iran may be doing something, this report doesn't prove it. But you wouldn't know that from listening to the Republican candidates. You wouldn't know it from reading it, the columnists in American newspapers.
Yeah, that's right. All except Ron Paul last night. We're all ready to go after Iran based on this report, and they all left the impression that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, which is unfortunate because the people watching that show maybe will listen to that and believe it. And, of course, it's not true. There's no evidence to suggest that. In the IAEA report, to my astonishment, they cited this laptop that surfaced back about 7 or 8 years ago, that even at that time was believed to be a forgery either of the Israeli intelligence service, Mossad, or the United States intelligence service, CIA, to suggest that Iran had been experimenting with design of possible nuclear warheads. Now, that was 7, 8 years ago, and they trotted this out again.
Last night, Michelle Bachmann, once again, and she did this before, claimed that Ahmadinejad has publicly threatened to launched nuclear attack on Israel and the United States. He's never done anything of the sort, and he keeps getting misquoted, not just by Bachmann, but by others. We have a lot of questions about Ahmadinejad, but the fact is he has never said or threatened an attack on Israel other than a retaliation for an Israeli attack on Iran. Isn't that correct?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I don't speak Farsi either, but certainly people that have native fluency in that language who've examined the texts that are cited to claim that Ahmadinejad has been threatening to attack Israel, the statements say nothing like that. And, you know, another interesting thing I would point out, which I'm sure you're aware of, is that Ahmadinejad, as much as he's demonized, is in fact a reformer within the Iranian system. The hardliners, the real hardliners, are on the Supreme Religious Council. And so it's kind of interesting how this guy has been portrayed.
My guest is Philip Giraldi, the Council of National Interest, and we're talking to him about Iran. I want to get into this story that's dropped in the pages at the moment, but is now being treated as fact. The arrest of an Iranian-American businessman in Texas who is accused of trying to recruit the Zeta Mexican drug cartel to come across the border into Washington, D.C., of course, where they'd be easily recognized, and assassinate the Saudi ambassador, not just assassinate him, but blow him up in his favorite dining place, which would obviously kill a number of Americans sitting in that restaurant, as well as members of Congress. Even some critics, strong critics of Iran, in the mainstream say this is a cockamamie setup, is obviously a sting. But what's your opinion of this?
Well, there are a couple things here. I think this certainly started out as something, in that there was certainly some criminal activity of some kind that was being contemplated. But given the involvement of the Zeta gang, I would rather suspect this had something to do with drugs. And if you read very carefully the indictment, you'll see that there really is not anything in it that is that explicit about killing ambassadors or anyone else in terms of what is being quoted regarding what the guy said. So I have this strong suspicion that this is going to be a case like many others we've seen over the last 10 years, where it's basically the insertion of an FBI informant that makes this case go in a certain direction and turns it into a terrorist case. I think we've seen this happen repeatedly, and FBI agents are promoted and rewarded on the basis of catching terrorists, not on the basis of letting people off the hook. So I think that this, my suspicion is that this is something not innocuous, but nevertheless something that certainly is far less than the terrorist case that's being cited, and that that will eventually emerge. But this guy will still probably go to jail for 20 years.
Whenever the case goes to court, but they don't even need to have this case go to court. There are already the websites of the pro-Israel think tanks are declaring it a confirmed fact that this thing occurred, and that it was directed by the Hoods, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. You know, what's interesting is we see the very same individuals who not only brought us the war in Iraq and drummed it up, but took credit for it, are pushing for the attack on Iran. It was under PNAC, Project for New American Century, their listeners remember, but they kind of disappeared and they morphed into a couple of groups called what appears to be the Foreign Policy Initiative and the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, which just appeared 2 days after 9/11. And they have a broad or stable of columnists and members of their think tanks who get articles in the mainstream media every day of the week. And Iran has been in their crosshairs since the beginning. Maybe you could talk about them.
Yeah, you're right. These people have a survivability which doesn't go along with their record, because they've been wrong about almost everything. A number of them migrated over from the American Enterprise Institute and have now founded these new institutions. There was an astonishing piece last weekend in the New York Times in which two of them, Ruel Gerecht and Mark Dubowitz, basically they're from FDD, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, both of them saying, making the argument essentially that if the United States initiates much harsher restrictions on trade with Iran, this actually will benefit the United States consumer because oil prices will go down. I mean, you have to read this to believe the kind of convolutions they go through to explain this, but clearly they're making an attempt to tell the public that, gee, it won't be that bad if we really have to go after Iran. So these people are definitely around. They're on every Sunday morning on the talk shows. Bill Kristol is the head of the FDD. He's the editor-in-chief of the Weekly Standard. And it's the same characters that, you know, you just keep seeing over and over and over again.
He is also the person who founded something called the Emergency Committee for Israel, which appeared in the last election, which targets any candidate which isn't willing to put Israel's interest before that of the United States. And they ran big ads against a congressman who was pro-Israel, a veteran, actually, in Pennsylvania in the last election. And they ran one against a Democrat in New York in a special congressional election. And they've also run one against the Occupy Wall Street. And they get away with it. I mean, Kristol is like a Teflon man. You see him like everywhere. It's extraordinary. Nobody calls these folks on it. You do, and some other people, alternative media. But in the mainstream, you see Crystal there all the time, and he gets called by from NPR, and as if he is some non-biased expert who will give you a straight story.
Yeah, and of course they're the insidious, you know, limousine conservatives, the people like David Brooks. That appear to be more understanding and compromising, but in reality they're selling the same snake oil. There's no question about it. And these people have a survivability in the system because the system basically agrees with them. It's a shame, but that's, I think, where it comes down to. The system likes war, the system likes conflict because it's good news, and the system benefits from it directly because the all the money that's being generated by all of this nonsense is something that keeps them going.
But there's a certain point where the interest of U.S., I mean, not altruistic, but general interest of U.S. and Israel clash. Here's a situation when you've written about it, and I mentioned on my program where Congress has passed laws that restrict the limit of the activity of the President of the United States when it comes to dealing with issues which involve Israel. And in this case, the most recent is this legislation which was passed and which prevents the President or any U.S. official from talking to anyone connected with Iran without informing the House Foreign Relations Committee 15 days in advance that this is necessary for American interest. This is a totally unprecedented step for Congress trying to make U.S. foreign policy.
Well, it also basically eliminates any kind of diplomatic option with Iran, and it means essentially that your only option is war. And it's clearly that's what it's intended to do. This was supported very strongly by AIPAC, and it's very similar to that legislation that we see playing out at the United Nations now over the Palestinians. Essentially, I mean, America is unilaterally removing itself, diplomatically speaking, from the rest of the world. I think a lot of the rest of the world will welcome that, but the fact is that it means that in terms of what the U.S. government is able to do to benefit the American people, which is what it's supposed to be doing, it's really going into all these things with its hands tied, because so many of these policies are constrained by Israeli interests.
Oh, there's another piece of legislation you've also written about. This would restrict any company that does business with the United States from doing any business with Iran. Mm-hmm. Like if Iran buys Mercedes cars, and Mercedes is a standard car you see throughout the Middle East, that means that Mercedes cars could not be sold in the United States.
Right, and it would close down the Mercedes factory in South Carolina. It's amazing that they would pass this legislation and knowing exactly that what the consequences might be. It was Ron Paul, I think, that pointed out that the sale of just one single Mercedes truck or car to Iran could and would trigger a ban on Mercedes sales in the United States and also close down the factory. I mean, how many jobs would that cost the American economy?
Well, the legislation is still on the floor, hasn't been passed yet. There's another piece of legislation, maybe that's the same one, I'm not sure, that would prohibit any bank, any company or any bank that dealt with the Central Bank of Iran from dealing with any bank in the United States. And that would essentially designed to shut down Iran's economy, but would also impact ours. And just the other day, President Obama issued an executive order that fell short of that. It was kind of warning to countries about dealing with Iran's central bank. And whether that's good enough for this House Foreign Affairs Committee headed by an uber Israeli, I shouldn't say a gusano American from Cuba, Ileana Ross-Layton, who has put Israel's interest above that of the United States since she came to Congress.
Yeah, that's right. I think you're right that the legislation has not been passed, and Obama stopped short of doing that. But the fact is that it's still on the table. It's still something that's being discussed. And the thing with these congressional when Congress passes these bills, the president is bound by them. And if it says that the U.S. government will not talk to an Iranian diplomat, or the U.S. government will not allow a company to operate in the U.S. that sells anything to Iran, or whether it's, you know, that anybody that banks either directly or indirectly with an Iranian bank, I mean, this stuff is only going to hurt us.
Well, you know, and here, of course, it's always election season. Sometimes it's hotter than others. And right now, it is very hot. And we see the Republicans, other than Ron Paul, competing to see who can be more aggressive in support of Israel and in opposition to Iran. And of course, that puts the president in a bind, and he's already been humbled, I don't know how many times, by Israel. There's now talk in Israel, and the Israeli papers have been filled with this, but now the likelihood of an Israeli attack in the spring, and the predictability, the confidence Israel have that the United States, the Congress, would jump up and clap its hands. Do you think an attack is really likely, or is this just going to play out, or is it a difficult one to call at this moment?
I think this is one of those difficult ones to call. I think that going by the history of this, Israel has raised the ante on this a number of times before, and there have been various warning signs suggesting that Israel would be staging a military attack, but it has never done so. But this time, yeah, I think it's a little bit different. They've really been raising this issue extremely aggressively now for some months, and they keep saying that this is the last chance. I think the language is a lot stronger, and I think the insistence on it is a lot stronger. And I do agree with you that their mindset clearly is that if they initiate this, like Ron Paul last night was the only one of the Republicans who, when asked the question, if Israel started a war with Iran, would we jump in to support them? And he said no. But the others certainly would say yes. So I think the Israeli thinking on this issue is that the United States would inevitably have to support Israel if Israel started the war. And if they think that way, then they might think it's worth their while to do it.
Well, they seem to have such belief in the control of Congress. And, of course, back in May when Netanyahu, after 3 days earlier having insulted the President of the United States, received 29 standing ovations. He couldn't get that in the Israeli Knesset. He couldn't get one, ironically. That's kind of a message that they take, that they can do anything here because the most important occupied territory they have is the U.S. Congress.
Well, I think that's an accurate assessment on their part. I mean, I think when you talk about how Israel controls the U.S. Congress and the media, I think a lot of this control is paper thin. I know I've talked to congressmen privately, and they really resent the control that Israel asserts, but they just don't see where they have any alternative but at least to go with the flow. And I think that's a lot of what we see, and I think that's probably true also in the media. But the fact is, you know, as long as politicians and media people perceive that it's better not to criticize Israel than to do so, we're not going to change this thing. And that's why it's so important to have things like your news, your broadcasts, and also the alternative media out there where we're able to talk about these issues, because they are coming out more and more into the public forum. And I think the very fact that in the past 6 months, we've seen open discussions about cutting foreign aid, and also particularly cutting foreign aid to Israel. This is a breakthrough, I think, in some ways.
Well, actually, given the economy, it's certainly a talking point when to make the pretense or a politician to say that the $3 billion in military aid to Israel, whose economy is better than ours, and has its share of billionaires, that is sacrosanct. We can't cut the aid, but we can cut everything else here. We could cut aid to Medicare. We could cut Social Security. We could do everything, but we can't touch Israel. This is something I think the average American would think twice about and say, why is this the case?
Yeah, exactly. I think that the issue is starting to come out and is starting to be discussed, and I think this is significant. just 1 year ago, I'm sure that something like this would have never even surfaced. It surfaced during the election campaign of Senator Rand Paul, where he was talking about cutting all foreign aid, and it seems to have not gone away. It occasionally comes out again, and I was surprised when a couple weeks ago Walter Pincus in the Washington Post even had a very thoughtful article discussing the issue. Now that Walter Pincus to discuss that, and also in the Washington Post, is pretty impressive.
Given that he was supposed to have close ties to U.S. intelligence for years.
Yeah, and of course is himself Jewish, and,
yes,
and has always been perceived as a friend of Israel. So the fact that this is coming out in that kind of place is important.
Yeah, I found that interesting myself. One thing, it seems to be that one of the reasons there has not been attack on Iran is that the Pentagon is against it completely. But Panetta just went over there the other day and came back, and evidently, at least according for the media, that he got no assurance that Israel would give a warning to the United States before it attacked, which it's difficult to believe. But given the leadership, or what passive leadership in Israel these days, one never knows.
Yeah, I think those press reports, from what I've heard from my own contacts in the government, are accurate, that the Israelis just basically stonewalled Panetta. They said that this is our own security issue, and we don't have to clear it with you. So that I think is accurate. But I think and what you were suggesting earlier in your comment was that the Pentagon and I would add in also the intelligence agencies are strongly opposed to the U.S. getting involved in this war. They have a better understanding, I think, of just how catastrophic it could be.
It's now 9:49, and my guest is Phil Giraldi. And if you have any comments or questions, the number here, of course, is 895-2448, and 895-2448. Right, this is anyone, even someone who's inclined to support Israel, and actually there are many supporters of Israel in this country who are very much against an attack on Iran for that very reason. Well, we have a first call here. Let's go to our first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I've kind of cut to kind of like a wireframe of the situation. It just when you look at the dollar and how it's enforced by military might, you can see the patterns there. Saddam went off of the dollar, and we see what happened to him. Iran is holding back the international bankers and all that stuff that want to get their, you know, claws into them with their loans and their interest-paying scenarios. And there have been countries that have resisted that, Germany between World War I and World War II.
You have a question on that?
I would invite comment on that, but it just seems that democracy has come to mean the Rockefeller-Rothschild banking system.
Okay, thank you. Do you have a comment on there was a talk that we reason we went to war with Iraq is that Saddam was going to deal in euros, and of course there was a talk about Iran opening its own bourse, although I doubt if any other countries would be involved with it. Do you have any comment on that?
I would say that the ability of the U.S. Treasury to basically print money, because the dollar is a reserve currency for most of the world for buying oil, that's a large part of freeing up our government to engage in all these adventures overseas. If they couldn't do that, and they actually had to consider even coming close to balancing a budget, they wouldn't be able to even consider these wars. So it's an important consideration, yes.
Thanks. We have another call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I wonder whether Phil Giraldi can comment on the position of the Saudis. I can't find any rationale for the Saudis to support U.S. policy with regard to Iran if the Iranians might block the Straits of Hormuz as a result of an Israeli attack, and certainly wouldn't give them access through refueling stops in Saudi Arabia?
Thanks for the question.
Yeah, that's a good question and a very complicated one. The Saudis have a couple of things that they would be considering. First of all, they are rightly fearful of the Iranians because the Iranians are their neighbors, and there is a strong Shiite minority in the oil-producing regions of Saudi Arabia, and there's been some unrest there. So they're very nervous about the Iranians and would like the U.S. to, rein them in, let's put it that way. In terms of oil exports, the Saudis have been ramping up their capability to export the oil in the other direction towards the Red Sea, and they've been working on pipelines and capacity to do that. So they probably would come out of a closure of the Straits of Hormuz better than almost anyone else.
Well, also, wouldn't you say it seems they're upset with the result in Iraq, in which a Sunni regime that had been there dominated Iraq, Mesopotamia for decades, centuries, is now dominated by Shia, and this was obviously the reason that they sent their tanks into Bahrain when they had the uprising there. So there's something there. I think wouldn't you say that transcends oil?
Yeah, there are a whole lot of issues, and the Saudis are certainly feeling somewhat in a nervous state at the moment. And what happened in Iraq was not a good result for them. What's going on in Syria? They're in fact involved in kind of stirring it up, but that's not been a good result for them either. And Lebanon has been a problem for them. They're involved in the entire region with their intelligence services primarily, They are quite nervous about the way things are going.
Speaking of Lebanon, there was a report in the papers about Hezbollah, which the United States has made into an enemy, as it makes all Israel's enemies into our enemies, breaking up a ring of CIA informants in Lebanon, which has been kind of devastating to U.S. intelligence there. But that intelligence seems more engaged in getting information on Israel's behalf. What would you say about this?
Well, I think the U.S. only has a limited interest in what Hezbollah is up to. And you're quite right. I think the interest in that group is basically something that's been driven by the Israeli connection. It seems that there was in the intelligence business they call tradecraft, how you run agents and that sort of thing. It was very poorly conducted. Hezbollah was able to figure out initially that the U.S. was using a couple of restaurants in Beirut as places to meet its agents, and then was able to zero in on them and basically wound up arresting maybe all the agents that the CIA was running inside Lebanon. So it's a major setback, but again, it depends on how you look at it. I don't consider Hezbollah to be a major threat against the U.S., so it probably is not that important at that level.
You know, they keep on repeating a story, whether true or not, that Hezbollah has killed more Americans than any other country. And they're speaking, of course, about the attack on the U.S. base, Marine base in Beirut, where I was there at the time, in 1983. Hezbollah was in its infancy at that point. And who was behind that exact, whether it was Iran behind that, whoever was behind that, it's never been proven, but it's now assumed that Hezbollah was behind that. And, of course, this was after the United States and for the U.S. Navy had shelled Lebanon. New Jersey was dropping bombs in the hills of Lebanon at that point, so it wasn't, the U.S. was not there as a neutral party. But we keep hearing Hezbollah is the A-team, but they've never made even public threats against the United States.
When people come out with that argument, I point out that if Hezbollah is the A-team of terrorism, why haven't they done anything in the last 10 years? This is a joke. I think it was Armitage who made that line first.
Yeah.
And Hillary Clinton has come out with it too, and Madeleine Albright. But the fact is that this is a... this is a conflation of a threat against Israel with a potential threat against the United States. And the fact is, Hezbollah has never threatened the United States in the United States. and has never carried out a terrorist act here.
And we keep hearing about Hezbollah in Mexico, Hezbollah in South America, and yet nobody has been arrested in connection with Hezbollah. They've been able to make anything like that stick. It's another situation in which we're the only country, we and Israel, who consider Hezbollah to be a terrorist organization. They're dealt with by European countries and their coalition with the largest Maronite Christian parties in Lebanon is the dominant party in that country. And we never hear about their alliance with the Christians in the U.S. media.
Yeah, that's right. We see a very sort of simplified comic book version of foreign policy in this country, and it was clearly evident in the debate last night among the Republicans. The unfortunate thing is when you have this kind of viewpoint of the way the world works, you come up with bad responses, and we've seen plenty of that.
Well, Phil, we're just about to go off at the end of the hour, and people can read your articles by going to you have a website, right?
Well, no, I write on. Yeah,
you write. You can go on the CNI blog, Council for National Interest.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
www.cni.com.
Yeah, and also antiwar.com and the American Conservative.
Right, and you could see all the list of articles that Phil has written. Phil Giraldi, thank you so much for being a guest again today on Takes on the World. I look forward to speaking with you again.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff.
Take care. Bye-bye.